Blog Talk Radio.
This is Doug Kelly with Paranexus Universe, here with my friend and co-host Grant Rubin, Downstate Grant.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show tonight. We're so happy to have you.
Yes, today is Thursday, October 16, 2008. Unfortunately, we did not see a several hundred mile wide UFO over the southern hemisphere in Alabama this week, which is a bummer. I know Grant was so looking forward to it.
Yeah, I was waiting for it to drop those teddy bears and gummy bears and everything else and chocolates. And gosh, you know, I was sorely disappointed that it didn't happen.
I was too.
Yep.
Yeah, if only once. If only once it could happen.
Such is the nature of these prophecies.
On a different note, you know, here a few weeks back, we, of course, did a show on the Bigfoot hoax. And that was, of course, all over the news. And if you haven't learned this already, you'll be absolutely delighted to know that you can bid on the freezer and the costume that was used in that hoax. It's going to end tonight, just in a couple, 3 hours now. And right now the going price is just over $250,000 on eBay. Unbelievable.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. You know,
and you know,
you could
unfortunately,
probably buy one at your local costume store for $100.
Yeah, Goodwill.
Piece of history. Enough of that stuff.
Tonight we are very excited to have a special guest with us, Dr. David Jacobs. And let me just introduce him with a little bit of a bio here. Dr. Jacobs is Associate Professor of History at Temple University in Philadelphia, specializing in 20th century American history and culture. He is former director of the American Studies Program. Dr. Jacobs has been a UFO researcher for over 40 years. In 1973, he completed his doctoral dissertation in the field of intellectual history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison on the controversy over unidentified flying objects in America. He was only the second PhD degree granted involving a UFO-related theme. He has written and delivered many articles, papers, and addresses on the subjects of UFOs and abductions. He has been a consultant in major UFO organizations. Since 1977, he has offered the country's only regular curriculum university course on UFOs and abductions, UFOs in American history. Dr. Jacobs, in 1991, Dr. Jacobs and colleague Bud Hopkins conducted the highly publicized Roper Organization poll of the abduction phenomena. This was the first scientifically random poll to ascertain the potential number of abductees in the U.S. The results of that influential survey were published in the 1992 booklet, Unusual Personal Experiences. His bio goes on and on, lots of credentials. Dr. Jacobs, welcome to Paranexus Universe.
Well, thank you, Doug. I appreciate it.
Yes,
so nice
to
have you with us tonight, Doctor.
Grant, good to hear from you.
So, you have been researching UFOs for over 40 years. That makes you 34 instead of 29, right?
That's exactly right. How did you guess?
It's just math, you know. I mean, you can come to any truth with just math. It's all in the mathematics. So, what got you interested into this topic?
Well, you know, I don't really know what got me interested in it. I was an undergraduate at UCLA back in the 1960s, and this is actually the early 60s, and I just sort of read stuff about it and kind of got interested in it, and by 1965, I was very, very interested in it, and I sort of captivated by it in a strange way. And then in 1966, I began to do sort of serious research in it. And of course, that Life magazine, famous Life magazine article came out at that time. And I went off to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin that year, and I made up my mind then that I was going to do nothing but UFO research. I was going to become a so-called expert in the subject by reading every single word I could read about it, every word that was ever written. And actually, in those days, that was possible to do. You could actually do that, oddly, odd as that may seem. So I started to do it. Now, of course, it's completely impossible, and there's just thousands and thousands and thousands of books. Most of them are not worth reading, but there's just plenty of stuff. So I just sort of continued it and began to obsess on it and all that. And when I finally wound up writing my dissertation on the controversy over UFOs in America, I was sort of totally involved. And after I started teaching, I continued to do it and continued to write about it and publish articles and so forth. And here I am. I'm 109 years old, and I'm still doing it.
Well, you also worked with Dr. Alan Hynek, too, didn't you, Dr. Jacobs?
I'm sorry, what was that? I
said you worked with Dr. Alan Hynek. Isn't that correct?
Worked with
me. Affiliated with him?
Well, he wrote the introduction when my book was published as a university press book. When my dissertation was published, rather, as a university press book, he wrote the introduction to it, and we became friends very quickly. And I researched his files when I was doing work for the dissertation, and so we became friends, and were friends until he died, in 1986 or 87, I guess it was.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, Alan was. If ever there was a sweetheart of a guy, it was Alan Hynek. He was just an extremely gracious and nice person, and very, very intelligent. And he was something that we don't have now, really. He was sort of the scientist who was the voice of reason in the UFO phenomenon. He appeared quite often on the Michael Douglas Show, which was a variety show that came out of Philadelphia. Sort of like Johnny Carson and Jay Leno now and all that, and he was also on a lot of different other shows and radio programs, you know, trying to urge the scientific community to look at the subject, to take it more seriously, not to dismiss it out of hand and all that, and he made a very good case for it, and of course he had a very big career and he could afford to do things like that, because he was secure in his career. We really haven't had a scientist like that since Alan Hynek.
Yeah, it's really a shame because he did some wonderful work. In regards to when did you make the kind of the transition, or what was it that prompted you to become more interested in the abduction side of things, Dr. Jacobs?
Well, in 1982, I met Bud Hopkins in 81, and Bud Hopkins was a pioneer UFO researcher, abduction researcher.
Mm-hmm.
And we met at a conference in Chicago. But everybody knew that the abduction phenomenon was just stupid. Everybody knew that it was ridiculous. It was psychological. I mean, yes, there were a couple of cases that were very suggestive, like the Barney and Betty Hill case and all. But you needed to have serious patterns, which we did not have. You needed to have a lot of reports, which we did not have. And the chances of it being psychological were still very, very high. So when I was appearing at this conference with Bud Hopkins and a bunch of other people giving papers, when Hopkins gave his paper, I actually preferred to stand in the hall and talk with a friend of mine, Marcello Ciuzzi from Eastern Michigan University, and joke with him in the hallway rather than listen to Hopkins' paper on abductions. Because my sense was listening to Hopkins' paper would be sort of a total waste of time, whereas standing in a hall meant that I might be able to learn some new jokes from Marcello. That was my mindset. And the next year, however, in 1982, I was sort of reintroduced to him by a mutual friend in New York City, and I was fairly reluctant to go to his house, but I was invited there secondhand by this friend, and I sort of went along, and when I met him, I was immediately impressed by his intelligence and by the work he was doing and the structure of the work he was doing and the systematic quality of it, and he was... very, very, very articulate, and believe me, in this area, there are few and far between in terms of being intelligent and articulate when it comes to a scattered phenomenon such as UFOs. So I sort of got taken in a sense, and I got more interested in it, and he sort of showed me what he was doing, and I began to sit in on his hypnotic sessions, and I began to meet abductees that he gathered together for his group meetings and so forth. And when that happened, I began to realize that he was onto something, that he really was onto something. And, you know, the interesting thing was is that very day when I first met him, to backtrack a little bit, it turns out that we were both vacationing in the same small town in Cape Cod, and he owns a house in Wellfleet, and we just rented a place for a couple of weeks, so I was able to meet with him again in Wellfleet and talk with him and so forth. So we had this other kind of odd sort of coincidental vacation spot. But by 1986, by 1984, 2 years later, I realized that in order for me to understand the abduction phenomenon, I would have to sort of do my own hypnosis, because in UFO research, you never trust anybody's research except your own, and even then you have to be very, very doubtful about it. And so I started to learn about hypnosis, and he sent me somebody who had written to him, who lived in Philadelphia, and I did my first session in August of 1986. And since that time, I've looked at about 1,100 different abduction events with about 150 different people over the years, and it's totally changed my life, I'll tell you that.
Well,
so that's sort of how I got into it, and how it all started. You know, I just got interested in it. I didn't see anything, nothing happened to me, there was no sudden event or anything like that. It was just that I got interested in it. That's the best I can put it.
So you've done quite a few cases, over 1,100, you say, since then?
Well, I've looked at 1,100 abduction events, working with 150 people, many of them for years on end.
Okay. And so...
In other words, there have been a group of people who came to me, and they came to me once and once only, and that was it. That was enough for them.
Sure.
And other ones I've had, you know, maybe... well, just tremendous numbers of sessions with over years.
Okay. Let's start with, what commonalities have you discovered among the cases you've done?
Well, of course, it's commonalities that are the critical event. That's what you're looking for. You're looking for patterns over time.
Sure.
And Bud had first discovered those. Those had not been discovered before. It wasn't something that we could put our finger on and point to and say, this is common, this is common, this is common, this is common, this is reported all the time. There just weren't enough cases. Hopkins, in his 1981 book, Missing Time, took 7 abductees, put them together, and said, here are the parallels, here are the commonalities, here are the patterns. And thereby, in a sense, you know, showed us that this could be done, that the patterns were there. So that's what I began to look for as well. Now, when I started out doing hypnosis with abductees, I made every mistake one could make in terms of technique, and the most important thing of all, which was sort of believing what people told me. That is, in fact, a fatal error, because there's a lot of confabulation, there's a lot of false memories, and one has to be very, very careful. But I wasn't. But I learned fairly early on, just almost serendipitously by accident, I learned that I had been horrendously mistaken about one person's testimony. And then at that point, I realized controls had to be put in place. Everything that is said, I've heard before in some way or another. If I haven't heard it before, it goes in the back burner, waits for people to verify it, who are unaware of the testimony. And I may think it's real and true, but I can't write about it as evidence until other people say the same thing, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
And once I sort of got my bearings in it, once I sort of got my sea legs, so to speak, I then began to find the patterns that Bud had found and the commonalities. And, of course, when you're dealing with commonalities, you have to deal with large numbers of cases. And basically what happens to people is I won't go into who found what when, but we now know that the phenomenon starts in infancy and goes through old age. It is not a single adult onset type of event.
Okay, can I interrupt you just real quick and ask you just a quick question related to that?
Sure.
Let me just repeat. If I understand what you're saying that the commonality is that this starts out in childhood and continues through their life. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is
okay.
It's not like I was walking in the woods one day and down came a flying saucer from Venus.
Okay.
That does
now,
not.
So let me ask.
Not a phenomenon.
So are there any cases that you have investigated where the onset was in adulthood, not in childhood?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, well, the onset was? Oh, no, I have never met anybody who had onset in adult as an adult.
Okay. Very good.
I've not had that. I have been cases that I've investigated when they were adults. Of course, I've investigated cases that happened the very same day that they came for a session. And,
oh, wow.
It's really only a matter of hours. And, of course, I've investigated many, many cases that happened the night before and the week before and all the rest of that stuff. And I've investigated cases that happened when a kid was 6 years old and 10 years old and all. So it's usually people, what happens is that when people come to me, they generally speaking have some sort of a triggering event, some sort of major event that impels them to come forward. And when they come forward, I ask them a series of questions. I have a sort of a questionnaire actually on my website, and I use that as a basis. And each one of those questions is calculated to tell me sort of what's been going on in their lives. And invariably, there is a whole series of odd experiences that have happened in their lives. And I use myself as a baseline. I have never ever had anything really unusual happen to me. I've never seen anything that would startle me in some strange way. I lead a life of fairly routine normalness in terms of odd things happening. Whereas abductees don't. They have all sorts of different experiences. And oftentimes the ones that actually get in touch with me, they've been wrestling with these sort of half-remembered dreams and non-remembered except for flash memories of events and odd missing time sequences and so forth. And what happens is that they tend to, when they deal with the subject, they tend to seek help. And once they realize it's something that's happening to them, or maybe they're crazy, they think. And, of course, some of them might indeed be. But for the most part, they'll seek help. And the first place they go is they're therapists. They're you know, they want to say, Doc, what's wrong with me? You know, I keep thinking that I'm lying on a table when there's somebody leaning over me, and there's like a sexual feeling or something sometimes, and sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night and there's somebody standing over my bed, and my response to that is just to go back to sleep. And so the doctor says, the psychologist usually says, well, yeah, that does sound delusional or something like that. And, or maybe you were sexually abused in childhood, and these are sort of memories that are bubbling to the surface that are twisted in some way to try to deal with the trauma of the abuse. And they work with the abductee, and of course they cannot ever get it solved, and they can't ever get it resolved because it continues to happen while they're having the therapy. And that just doesn't work out. So they will sometimes go to their priest or their minister, and when that happens, they get a diagnosis, and the diagnosis is demonic possession. You've been possessed by demons.
Yeah, brother.
Well, for many people, that's okay because it confirms to them that in fact this is something that's happening from the outside and not just being made up in their minds. And it does seem to answer a lot of things. Why they'll wake up and they'll find they're in another room or standing around. Their demonic possession made them do it, and they don't remember that and all that. And then they get a prescription, and the prescription is to pray it away. And that's what they do. They go home and they pray and pray and pray. And the problem is that it continues. It has no effect on it whatsoever. So they go back to the minister, and the answer, generally speaking, is, well, the problem with you is you haven't been praying hard enough. So they go back and they redouble their efforts to make it go away, and of course it doesn't go away, and then they get a little bit disillusioned and they go on to other areas. Sometimes they go to the New Age, and in the New Age they might find a certain resonance that appeals to them. In the New Age they might meet people who are in touch with alternative realities, or at least they think they are. And that seems to resonate with them. They get involved with channeling, and channeling channels spirits and aliens and also other people and so forth. And that seems to make sense to them too, because they can then receive a voice. They can hear a voice or something like that. And a lot of people then sort of stay there because most channeled messages, not all, but most channeled messages are warm and loving and make them feel good and all that. Although why they're scared to death every time they need to go to bed at night or when they're alone in the house, they don't know, but they sort of stay there. However, if they don't and they move away from that, and I've had a number of people who've moved away from that, and if they come to Bud Hopkins or to me, generally speaking, that's the end of the road. That's the end of it. They know what's happening to them. It answers all their questions. It makes sense. They begin to remember what happened to them. And then, of course, they have the whole phenomenon of having to deal with what is, in fact, happening to them. At least we think what is, in fact, is happening to them. So to get back to your original question, Doug, what is it that happens to them? What are the patterns? Well, it happens when starting in infancy and goes into old age. It stops somewhere in old age, and we don't know where. We don't see 90-year-olds or 100-year-old people walking around, but we do. Yeah, we will see 70-year-olds from time to time, but in less greater numbers now than we should see. But there might be statistical reasons for that, it happens to everybody, apparently, globally. In other words, this is not an American phenomenon or a British or Irish phenomenon, nor is it a French or German or Indian phenomenon, nor is it a Pakistani or a Thai phenomenon. You know what I mean? It's like most countries that we've heard of have abduction events. So it cuts across all economic, geographic, racial, religious, educational, intellectual, political, social, cultural lines. I can have a list a mile long, but it's completely random, and it is worldwide. and it's you got people who've dropped out of middle school or even grammar school sometimes. I've had a number of them, and people who have PhDs and MDs and who are doctors and lawyers and physicians and all that, and everybody in the middle. And so it's just an extraordinary phenomenon. Everybody describes the same thing. They're taken out of their home. It might be out of their car. It might be in the daytime. It might be at nighttime. It might be when they're asleep. It might be when they're awake. And they're taken on board an object. Their clothes are removed. They sit in usually, if it's it depends on the size of the object, but if it's a large object, they sit in a waiting room. There's other people, some of whom they might recognize from their neighborhood. They don't talk, they don't say anything, they just sit there sort of slack-jawed, glassy-eyed, stare at the floor, and then somebody comes in, gets them, takes them out of the room into a large other room oftentimes. I'm skipping a whole bunch of stuff here, but this is in general. Puts them on a
sure.
table and does a, quote, examination, end quote, of them. Now, for many years, everybody assumed the examination was the reason for abductions, because that was the old Barney and Betty Hill model. Adult onset, couple of people in the wrong place at the wrong time, they get grabbed, they're examined. And people held on to that idea that this was an examination, this was an experiment, this was a study situation. They held on to that forever. Even now, in this day and age, many people who do abduction work cannot help but use the word experimenting. They're experimenting on us. And that's what I thought was happening when I first started doing this work. That was my mindset. That's how I asked questions. It was this experiment. I was very, very, very interested in the examination, et cetera, et cetera. Turns out that was wrong. There's really no evidence whatsoever that people are abducted for an examination. But there is an examination very, very often. It's almost always preliminary to the reason why they were actually abducted, to the actual reason why they were abducted, which can be a variety of different things. Now, on the table, well, sometimes, I'll get to that when we go to some of the other commonalities.
Okay, sure. Sure.
But listen, so you don't have to keep me talking. You can pipe in anytime you want to. I'm glad to stop.
I'm riveted. Just keep going. You're doing great.
So I'm a little bit hoarse. My voice is raised up a little bit because I did about 3 hours of lecturing today. So I'm a little bit hoarse. Sorry about that. But anyway.
Oh, no, you're fine. We can talk too if we give you a break.
No, that's. You got to wrestle me to the ground to get me to stop talking. That's my problem, actually.
All right,
but,
carry on.
While they're on the table, there are characteristic things that happen. There is a certain kind of examination, which we used to think was a bone or muscle examination, but which is not. Men report sperm being taken mechanically, usually, sometimes in other ways. Women report eggs being taken. They report fetuses being implanted in them, fetuses being extracted from them, and other gynecological events happen to them as well. And afterwards, they're taken off the table. Now you begin to get into a variety of things that can happen. One of the more common things is they're taken into a room and they see, let's just say, tanks filled with liquid, and in the liquid is suspended in the middle, it might be a fetus. Fetuses in various stages of growth and development, from embryos to sort of fully formed fetuses and all that. And they're told from time to time, not always, but they're told that, you know, one of these is yours or some of these are yours or something like that. They might see 10 of these containers. They might see 20. They might see 500. In other words, it depends on the size of the object and sort of what's going on in that object. But I've had from 10 to 500 approximately.
Wow.
And sometimes they're asked to hold a baby. I remember Bud Hopkins called me up in 1983 or 84 maybe, and he had discovered this amazing case. this astounding case. He was almost breathless with this case that he had discovered, where this woman was brought into a room and there were a bunch of babies in the room. And I thought to myself, babies? What the hell are you talking about? You know, what do you mean, babies? And he said, well, no, yes, there were babies. They were weird babies. They were ugly-looking babies. They looked like sort of a cross between human and alien. And so he said that they forced her to hold the baby. I thought, whoa, that is weird.
Mm-hmm.
And then they forced her to put the baby to her breast and feed the baby. And I
really?
Said, feed the baby? What are you talking about? That's not possible. Did she explain
WTF
to them?
Moment.
Right. I said, did she explain to them that she can't feed the baby? I mean, there's certain series of hormonal events that have to happen, and the pituitary gland, and this and that, and to have lactation. You can't just put a baby in your breast and start feeding
right.
the baby. So she said, he said, yes, yes, she's never been married or anything like that, but they forced her to put the baby to her breast anyway. And I thought at that point, God, this is the strange, this is so bizarre. There had been a couple of articles written by the very famous French UFO researcher, Amy Michel, that had appeared in the early 1970s in Flying Saucer Review, the British magazine. And he talked about how it could be that aliens are on such a different level of intelligence and communication that would be like us trying to talk to a cat. Well, I own a couple of cats, and one's real dumb and one's real smart. But I know that that the smartest one has a vocabulary of maybe 10 words, and she understands about 10 words, you know, and that's about it. So I thought to myself, well, maybe that's the way it is with them and with us, because this is a form of behavior that we cannot understand. A form of behavior that values form over content. In other words, the form is you put the baby to your breast. The content is there's no milk. There is no content. It values form over content. And so I thought, God, if this is happening the way Bud has been finding, and of course I hadn't been doing my own research yet, but if this is happening the way he's been finding, then maybe Amy Michelle is right. We'll never be able to communicate with them if this is in fact alien and not psychological. But it made communication to be like almost impossible. Well, I was wrong, of course, and we learned that in fact the procedure had already taken place where the lactation is stimulated, and people feed the babies all the time even though they've never had a baby in their life, and it's mm-hmm. not some sort of growth on their pituitary gland or anything like that. It's all done very, very systematically, and I can tell what procedure it is beforehand, and I know when I see that procedure on the table that I know later on they're going to feed a baby. But so that's a great commonality there. Then now there's a variety of other things that can happen to them. You know, they might be directed to a room where they have to work some sort of an apparatus and do certain things, which I call testing procedures. There's a variety of other things, most of which we have many, many reports about. And when it's all over, they take them back to the room where they were sitting before. They get their clothes on. They bring them back to their car or to their apartment or whatever it is. And within seconds, if not even at the point of coming back en route, they forget what has happened to them. So they know that, wait a minute, I was standing at my dresser, and it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and now I'm still standing at my dresser, and it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon now. How can that be?
Mm-hmm.
I just won't think about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go on with their day, see? And of course you can't have a phenomenon where you're missing 2 or 3 hours, and you don't know where you were, and nobody else has seen you. And let's just say you might be in another room, or you might be in your car, and you're driving your car and you saw a white light, and then it's 3 hours later and you're still driving in your car, yet you're in basically the same spot. That just can't happen. It can only happen if you've had a stroke or something like that that has severely impaired your memory. But it wouldn't just be for that one little spot. Unless there was serious trauma, you were in an accident, then you don't really remember what happened the next couple of hours. But then you'd be in an accident. Then you'd be laying in a hospital or on the tarmac or wherever you are. You know what it is? You know what I mean? So it just doesn't happen to people who are relatively normal in every other way. And, of course, that's a commonality, a missing time, as Hopkins called it and all.
Mm-hmm.
And this displacement in space, you were in one place 1 minute, and then seemingly a few seconds later, you're in another place, and it's hours later and all that. So the thing about the abduction phenomenon is that it's all commonalities, and there's something else about it that we've discovered, and that is that, now, I'm not casting aspersions on areas that I know nothing about, but when we take a look at ghosts, and when I talk about ghost research, saying the phrase ghost research is the total amount of knowledge that I have about it. That's it, the phrase. However, I will then proceed to talk as if I know everything about it, because that's what we do in the paranormal area. When you talk about ghosts primarily, what people describe with ghosts is basically ghost sightings.
Mm-hmm.
It's a night, somebody's there, a shadowy figure, maybe there's a coldness, maybe they feel something there, maybe they see something, maybe it's a sea captain, maybe it's a deceased relative, whatever it is, they see something. Why the person is there is open to debate. How that ghost got there is really sort of unknown. Why some people are ghosts and others aren't, we don't know. Why they would go a-haunting in a certain place is a matter of conjecture. What they do when they're not haunting is unknown. How they get their energy to haunt is unknown. Where they get their orders to haunt if they're going to go from one place to another is unknown. In other words, we don't really know a whole heck of a lot about ghosts other than people say they see them.
Exactly.
Or that they feel them. And that's the way it's been for the past 120 years or whenever the British Psychical Society was founded. And with the abduction phenomenon, we have tremendous depth. We know one hell of a lot about this subject. We know lots of hows and some whys. We know all sorts of things about it. It's the only paranormal phenomenon that happens to people as opposed to channeling, which emanates from the mind and goes somewhere else. That happens to people, which has serious, serious depth to it. And that makes it sort of remarkable and extraordinary. And here's something else that everybody has to understand. This is a phenomenon that is based on UFOs. This is the UFO phenomenon. The abduction phenomenon is the UFO phenomenon. That's the reason that UFOs are here, in my opinion, to abduct people. And there's an agenda here. So what I found, to make a long story short, mercifully so, is that it's not an experiment, it's not a study, it's not a learning situation. The evidence does not hold for that. It never did, and we didn't know it. It seemed to because we didn't know enough. Now we know a lot more about it, and you realize that's not it. What it is, in my opinion, from what my own research tells me, is a program. And as a program, it has a beginning, it has a middle, it has an end, and it's goal-directed. In other words, they're here for a reason, and they're conducting this program to fulfill the goals of that reason, and everything is logical, everything is thought out. They're not interested in us as a study lab rats or something like that. Although people feel like they're lab rats all the time, that is not the reason. So that's sort
all
of
right.
where
okay,
we're at now.
That's, so, and we'll, of course, go on and discuss that in a bit. Let me ask you some follow-up questions, some from the chat room. On the examination table in that particular area, is there any evidence in your research about them doing any kind of mental or psychological examinations?
Absolutely. Well, the first thing I discovered was the actual physical examination was unlike, well, Hopkins discovered this, that it was unlike any doctor's examination that we know of. Even Barney Hill described sort of one of the tiny procedures that they do during the examination phase is they run their finger and their thumb down a person's backbone from the neck all the way down to the coccyx, the tailbone, you know, and then back up again and then coming back down the coccyx and all that. And they do other things. One day we've always puzzled as to what any of this means and what the other procedures mean during the abduction. And then one day I was reading a book about how doctors should perform neurological exams in their offices. I was actually just looking through this book for reasons that escape me now, but it's not my normal kind of reading. And I recognized immediately what was happening. And this is a neurological examination, not a physical examination in the way in which we normally know it. It might have some interest in bones, it might have some interest in muscle and tissue, but it's basically a neurological exam that people go through.
Really?
And that is involved with another thing that I discovered early on in around 1987. And that is that I was doing a session once with a woman who said that she had flown with the angels. And I didn't know how to deal with this. Now, this is early on. I was still mistake-prone and all that. And so...
Good thing now you're perfect.
Oh, yes, now I'm perfect, right. As I say on my website, there's absolutely no possibility that I have avoided error. but anyway... she said she'd flown with the angels. When she was younger, she flew with the angels. So that was intriguing enough to me. So she was in bed at the time, and an angel entered into her house, and into her bedroom, rather, and she flew up with the angel. So I sort of started over again. Okay, now where does the angel come from? In other words, is he just standing there, or is, oh, no, he's up at the, he's coming into the window. Okay. And then he comes down and he stands by her bed, and then she gets up, and then they fly up. See, I said, "Well, how high do you go?" "Oh, well, we're in the ceiling now. We're in the ceiling." And I said, "What's he doing while you're at the ceiling?" She said, "Well, he's showing me a piece of paper. He's showing me something to read." And it seemed just a little odd to me. You know what I mean there? Their heads are bobbing against the ceiling, I guess, and he's showing her a paper. It just doesn't seem angelic.
Right.
And so we started over again, and this time they sort of both flew out the window, and then there was this light, and then they went to this object, and then they did this to her, they did that to her, they did this to her, and then they took her into another room, and then they showed her this paper, she says. Now, I'm not sure of this, whether it's true or not, but... And then she's staring at the paper, and I said, "Well, what's on the paper?" And she said, "It's a list of boys' names." Now, once again, you've got to be very careful with this, because in those days, I'm just accepting everything that people are telling me. And I said, "Well, are you memorizing them?" Like he said, there's going to be a war, and you have to memorize those names, and then come back and recover the names. And she said, "No." She's sort of looking around. But she's also looking at the paper. And then at that point, I did not know what to ask her. I didn't know where to go from there. It's like, oh, that's interesting. And for some reason, I just sort of stumbled on the question. And the question is, well, what's he doing while you're staring at the paper?
Uh-huh.
And she said, well, oh, he's standing next to me, and he's looking at me. Which is not what I expected. And I said, well, where is he looking? You know, where is he looking at you?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, he's looking in my eyes.
Hmm.
I said, well, how close is he to you? And she pointed maybe an inch away from her, off to the side, staring into her eye. And I thought, what the heck is that? What is that all about? You know, that's so bizarre. Then I had another person who sort of, I asked her similar sorts of questions. She's lying on the table, and she also indicated she was being looked at. And I said, well, where is this person looking, this alien? At your toes, at your knees? You know, no, he's looking at my head. Well, is he looking at your chin, you know, your ears? Well, where? No, he's looking at my eyes. And I said, well, how close is he to you? And she said, well, his forehead is touching mine.
Really?
And I said, yeah. I said, well, can you look away? She said, no. I said, can you close your eyes? She said, no. Then once again, I was just stumped. And I blurted out a question that just came to the top of my head. I had no idea where I was going. I didn't have a direction. And the question was, well, what's going on in your mind while he's doing this? And that question opened up this whole world of neurological activity and manipulation that is accompanies all abductions. And this is an event that happens to all abductees, and there are no exceptions to this. And what he can do is he can elicit feelings, he can look at memories, he can do all sorts of things. Now, it took me a long time to figure out, years, in fact, because I'm kind of slow on the uptake, to figure out exactly how he was doing this. But I did eventually figure out a good theory as to how he's doing it, which means that he's, in my opinion, and a medical doctor I ain't, obviously, but in my opinion, he's hooking into the optic nerve, using it as a conduit through the optic chiasm into the lateral genicular body and into the inner recesses of the brain, various lobes, and he can innervate sort of any neurological sites by doing that, and he can pretty much do what he wants to do. Now, the problem here is that he's not attached to the person. There's no wires or anything like that. He's just looking. And the question then is, well, how do they do that? And the answer is, beats the hell out of me.
It sounds like a Vulcan mind meld of sorts.
That's probably as close as an analysis as one can get. Whatever it is, he can do
it. Is it telepathic?
All communication is telepathic, but it's not necessarily a function of distance.
Right.
All communication is telepathic.
But when they've got their face in the abductee's face with their eyes open, is it like they're telepathically connected to their brain where they can manipulate or read thoughts? Or?
Well, the way I use the word telepathically is usually a matter of communication, telling them something or receiving some information from them. So as telepathic communication. And that also has to do with, in some way, transmitting. And I'm gonna have to use this word because in want of a better word, some sort of energy, which connects to the brain and vice versa. And I guess that in some way they're transmitting a far more concentrated form of energy that can actually do physiological things to a brain. In other words, people will feel, I can tell what's happening to people by what they tell me is going on in their mind. And sometimes, though, they tell me, well, I'm beginning to feel a pain in my neck. I'm sort of feeling a pain in my shoulder. Now the pain is going down to my backbone. Now it's going down to my coccyx. And you can just follow neurologically down the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous systems, sort of what they're innervating, where they're going by this neurological procedure. Now, when I first heard it, I had no idea what it was, and I didn't know what was going on, and I had, you know, this Vulcan mind meld. So I called this mind scan.
Mm-hmm.
I rue the day that I ever used that word. I've heard this word on television now and here and there, and it's so science fiction-y. I prefer to use a more neutral and professional phrase called neural engagement. Now, Whether this is neural engagement or not, it's nothing to do with anything. In other words, I don't know what it is. I don't know how they do it, but it seems to me that they're engaging neurally in some way. And it's cumbersome, but I just can't stand that word that I coined, mind scan. I just can't stand it. I hate it. Printed it up. Everybody can read it.
And they can certainly, through that, whatever mechanism they're using, they use it to not only impart or implant memories, but they also use it to calm the person or stimulate them or plant information. Wouldn't you say, Doctor?
Absolutely. They can use it for whatever purposes they want. They can control us, and we cannot do that to them. That's a fundamental difference between them. So, and us, I should say. So, now, this business about staring, this staring procedure, happens to every single abductee. There are no exceptions to this. There are, I cannot emphasize that enough. There are no
exceptions. Sounds like a combination of hypnosis as well.
Well, it's not really hypnosis. When the abduction starts, let's just say if a person is sitting on the couch watching television, when they look over to the side and they think somebody's in the room. Now, normally, if you think somebody's in the room and you're home alone, you're going to get a really strong surge of adrenaline. You know, somebody has entered the room, the doors were locked, and there's somebody there. It just, you're not going to be able to help it. It's just going to happen because it might be robbers, who knows what, and it's going to scare the living daylights out of you. So, but that doesn't happen. They're rendered passive almost immediately. They can't reach underneath the couch pillow and get out their trusty Magnum 44. They can't do that. They can't dial 911. They can't run out of the house screaming. They can't do anything like that. They just sit there, and they are rendered passive from the get-go, from the very beginning of the abduction event. From that instant, they're rendered passive. Without that ability to control people and get them to be passive, there would be no abduction phenomenon. Because they would get out their 44s and blow their little heads off. You see what I mean? It can't not be that way. They must be passive. They cannot be active. And these beings can do it, and they can do it from a distance. Now, I don't know if that distance is 4,000 light years away. I have a feeling it's a matter of feet more than anything else. But it is done. And that is the ability that they have to control us, and we can't control them. Now, that's sort of a gross anatomical passiveness. That's not the ability to examine their thoughts on a minute level and find out what they were eating for dinner the night before. See what I mean? They can't do that when they're rendering.
It certainly shows the fact that they have a pretty good understanding of how our how we work physiologically, and how that flight or fight. Reaction that we have, they've certainly overcome that with us.
It's just disconnected, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that when we first began to hear about this, you just got the sense that this was something that was so totally unexpected. I mean, we knew that if this were alien, if this were extraterrestrial, that by definition, it had to be extremely, extremely advanced technologically. They had to have the energy, the power, the this, the that. This had to be a civilization that was older than ours, or at least that advanced faster technologically, that was just amazing. But what we did not know, because we had hung on to this experiment idea for so long, was that their knowledge of physiology, of human anatomy, and of neurology especially, was also enormously advanced. That just threw us for a loop when we began to understand that. That came out of nowhere. Nobody had expected that, especially assuming that they're, grabbing people and pulling their legs off and seeing what's inside and all that. The experiment model. But in fact, we now know that they must have this in order to conduct the abduction phenomenon, and that is, in fact, what people describe.
You know, well, must have felt kind of comforting to us, or some folks in the community may have felt it was comforting, because we do much the same thing to you know, in our research with our animal, you know, experiments, you know, and anesthetizing bears and this sort of thing. So I guess we kind of thought there was some sort of a comfort level there, but by what you're describing, that kind of blew that right out of the water.
It did. It did. And of course, if we were to go to Mars and see little Martians running around, we'd grab a couple of them and pull their legs off. Just because that's what we would do. And for all we know, they might have, in fact, done that at one time in the past. Maybe in the 1880s or 1890s when this phenomenon first began, we think. Maybe that's when it happened. I mean, they had to do some sort of examination of us in terms of whether we were ready for their program, we were the correct species or whatever. I mean, they chose us, and they didn't choose kangaroos, you know. So so the point is, though, that probably did happen, but it's not what we see in the abduction phenomenon. That is, it does not come up, that sort of experimental thing. So so the point was, though, that their abilities neurologically are just phenomenal, just. Well, let's put it this way. They're irresistible. Now,
all right.
Maybe yes and maybe no. If you bring me back to this in the next hour, I'll tell you some of the maybe yeses and maybe nos.
Okay, cool, because I want to explore that a little bit more, and then we'll get into what you have found or believe concerning their agenda and so forth. But we are coming up at the top of the hour, and we really appreciate all of our listeners tuning in and in the chat room. And the questions, and Sharon, I haven't forgot our question. So I will ask that in the next hour. I do want to remind everyone that we have the Paranexus Conference coming up here in a little over a week from Saturday. And if you haven't had a chance to register, we'd love to have you there. It's in Tampa on October 25th, Saturday. If you can't make it in person, you might want to attend online. You can register to attend the live online broadcast, which we'll be doing all day long. It starts at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. And a lot of good speakers, a lot of good topics, obviously designed for paranormal researchers. And we're really trying to share knowledge, increase the level of everybody's knowledge, network, and have a good time as well. So take a look at that. Also want to mention Paranexus Academy, which we launched a couple of weeks ago. ParanexusAcademy.org is the URL where we are offering some very affordable courses. I've got one on Introduction to Hypnosis and Paranormal Research coming up in November, as well as the brand new Certified Founding Paranormal Investigators course, in addition to the Certified Paranormal Investigators course. And we've got others, and there's even some opportunities for instructors if you're interested in teaching a course. So take a look at that at ParanexusAcademy.org. Of course, the main Paranexus site is Paranexus.org, and we'd love to have you as a member there as well. Now, coming up in the next hour, we'll continue our discussion with Dr. Jacobs. Absolutely riveting conversation. We've got more questions and more to find out. So if you'll hang with us, we'll be back in just a few minutes. Hang tough. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy, and we won't think you're crazy. And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's spiritteam with one T, .org.
Is there a suppression of UFO and alien information by our government?
Does the soul continue on after we die?
Climb aboard the black ship of Paranormal Radio with your host, Captain Jack, on Contact Talk Radio and KRWM 106.9 FM HD3. Or visit WPRTRadio.com for more information.
Where will you find a professional association of paranormal researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where can you get research training, share data, and network with other researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where will you find a set of international standards for paranormal research groups?
Paranexus.org.
Paranexus is a global professional association of progressive paranormal investigators, parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, ufologists, and psychically gifted individuals focused on understanding the human condition through the scientific study of paranormal and psychical phenomena. And coming October 2008 to Tampa, Florida, the Paranexus Conference, a learning and networking event unlike any you've attended. Join us for 2 full days of innovative paranormal workshops. Participate in the Paranexus Challenge, where several teams will investigate a secret haunted location. Observe a live table tipping seance at the stroke of midnight. Join us for the Spirits and Shadows Costume Ball. See old friends, meet new friends, win prizes, and have fun.
Paranexus.org.
A place to learn, a place to share, a place to network, a place to come together. Join us now at Paranexus.org. And welcome back, everybody. Doug Kelly here with Grant Rubendunst. We are talking with Dr. Jacobs on alien abduction phenomena, having an absolutely fascinating discussion. If you have a question you'd like to ask, we've got the chat room there that you can ask it in, or you can give us a call. The number's there on your screen, 347-945-7799. We won't be able to take a lot of calls, but we will try to get them in. And so if you do call in, make your question real quick and then listen on the air if you would. And you can also use that click-to-talk button if you have a headset on your computer with you. That will be an easy way to. Again, appreciate all the interest and the activity in the chat room. Glad everybody's joining us for this incredible discussion. Dr. Jacobs, welcome back.
Thank you, Doug. Now, Doug, when you say you won't be able to take a lot of calls, is that your polite way of saying that there aren't a lot of calls?
Well, there. So far, nobody's called in, but that's typical. People tend to listen more than they call in. The switchboard is just buzzing, and I'm just trying to tell people to. Do you believe that? I wouldn't. That was a total lie right there. Okay.
I want to believe that.
No, we've got a lot of activity in the chat room, and I don't want to take a lot of calls because I want to give more time to the topic at hand. But if we run out of things to talk about, we'll take calls or we'll tell jokes, okay? One of the two.
Sounds good to me.
All right, so I have a question that something you'd mentioned earlier. You talked about the hypnosis and all that, and I do hypnosis as well, hypnotherapist, and have done some abduction regressions and so forth. And so here's my question, and this is also a question by Sharon in the chat room. Is there a method that you use to distinguish between, say, fabricated memories and real ones?
Well, there are. Of course, this is one of the first problems that you encounter. And the question is, how do you tell reality from fantasy? And
right.
In the beginning, I couldn't. I just couldn't do it. I thought I could. I thought I was smart enough to do that. But in fact, that was not the case. And when I take a look at my techniques, my hypnosis techniques back in 1986 when I first began to do this, I'm just appalled at how horrible I was, how terrible I was. You know, just I want to apologize to the people I worked with. It was just horrible. Mainly because I tended to believe what they said at face value, and that is, in fact, a fatal error. And I've told this story many times, but I'll tell it again because it's a life lesson, and it was a gift to me early on. The very first person I ever saw had this in the very first session that I ever did with her. This is to show you how long ago that was, you know, and how early it was. She talked about, we agreed that we were going to go take a look at a thing, an event that happened to her when she was like 7 or 8 years old or something like that. And she was with a friend. They were in Philadelphia. They were in a park, and the park sort of area sloped down to it. Some kids who were playing baseball. And she was with her friend, and she remembers she bent over to look at a buttercup or something like that, or maybe it was a butterfly. Or maybe it was a pat of butter. I'm not sure. It had the word butter in it. And all she felt was that she felt somebody sort of grabbing her around her waist, taking her and taking her up. And so we said, well, that sounds good to me. Let's look at that. Now, I had never done hypnosis with any human being in my life before, and I had studied it a little bit, and I had read up on it, and I had watched Bud Hopkins do a number of sessions. But I was scared to death and nervous as hell. And now, this woman actually had a history in channeling, and she actually offered some seminars in how to do channeling and all that. So she was quite well versed in hypnosis, and so we did a session, and she laid on my couch. I had my little condenser mic tape recorder next to her, and there she was. She bent over, she looked, she felt the arms around her, and this person carried her up into this object. And it was this guy who sported a page boy haircut or something like that, which I thought was pretty odd. And then she said that they took her clothes off, they put her on a table, they did this and that, and they did a gynecological procedure that was very, very, very embarrassing for her to talk about. And then they took her off the table, and they walked her down a hallway. And in the hallway, they met a small gray alien, and she was required to put her hands out and touch the small gray alien's head. And when she did that, there was love and kindness and warmth emanating from him and made her feel good. And when she took her hands away, it all sort of went away as well, the feelings. They then, this guy with the pageboy haircut, then continued to walk down the hallway with her and took her into a room where there was sort of a council of aliens set up. And the aliens talked to her, and they said that when she grew up, she was going to be intelligent and strong and brave and courageous and true and all that sort of stuff. And then they took her back in, they got her clothes back on, and returned her to the field. And we talked about it a little bit, and she left, and I was like flushed with victory. Oh my God, I've done it! I've done hypnosis with an abductee, and I've got this amazing, amazing, amazing story. And it's unbelievable. When I called up Bud Hopkins and we compared notes, and I said, you ever heard this, you ever heard that? And he hadn't actually, but we were both sort of, this is still early on, although we had published many times. Mm-hmm. And I was just thrilled. So I that night I took my tape recorder upstairs to transcribe everything that I heard onto my computer. And in my naivete, I thought that little tiny tape recorder with its condenser mic would pick up every word she whispered. And in fact, there was nothing on that tape,
oh,
except an occasional grunt and me asking some questions.
Well,
and I literally, this is literally true, I broke into a cold sweat. I just felt the blood drain out of my face. Oh, my God, I've lost it. I've lost it all, the treasure, this amazing account of an abduction. I've lost it. And I figured, well, I'll just remember what she said and type it out. And after you type about four sentences, you realize
right. That's
not going to happen. So she came back for another session. And then she came back, we did something else, and we came back for another session, we did something else, she came back, and a couple of months later I said, now, Melissa, remember that first session we did? She said, yeah. I said, well, I had a little trouble with the tape recorder, as I felt stupid even saying that. And I said, could we do that one again? She said, sure. So we start doing it again, and there she is, she's on the park, she's in the park. And she bends over and she looks at the butter cup or whatever it is, and she feels the arms around her, and there's this guy, the page boy, haircut, and takes her into her room and takes her clothes off and puts her on a table, does this to her and that to her, and does a gynecological procedure she's extremely embarrassed to talk about, and then takes her off the table, puts her clothes back on, and takes her back. I said, Melissa, remember the first time you talked about how you walked in the hallway and you put your hands on this other small alien's head and you felt his love and warmth and all that? He says, yeah, you know, I don't remember that happening.
Really?
I said, well, what about when they took you down the hallway into the room and there's the council set up and you're going to grow through a beautiful and brave, loyal, courageous, and true? She said, I think that happened to my friend Lydia, not to me.
Oh, no.
And I thought to myself at that point, I do not have the slightest idea what I am doing. I am an idiot.
You're kind of hard on yourself there, huh?
I knew immediately that I was doing it. Whatever it was, I was confident I was doing it right, and I was doing it wrong. And at that point, I began to set in controls. I vowed this wasn't going to happen to me again. And I think every person who's a serious researcher in this area comes to that position very quickly. So the rule of thumb is, if somebody says something you have never heard before, it goes in the back burner waiting for verification from somebody else who is not aware of this testimony. The more verification, the better. Rule number two is you ask purposely misleading questions to see if they'll bite, to see if they will go along with you. Now, everybody reports an alien who's dressed in yellow, who stands in the corner of the room and tears paper with his hands. Do you see him over there? or something like that, some off-the-wall thing.
Sure.
If they see him, there's a problem. Yeah,
right.
It's just a purposely misleading question, and these can be asked in a lot of different ways. We know we might have a thousand cases which tell us the answer, and then we just tell them something that is not the answer and see what they'll bite. And you say it in such a way as if this is normal and natural, and of course they're going to see it. And if they do, there's a problem.
All right.
And there's a lot of other ways you can control it so that you get material that is fairly solid.
Good stuff. All right, we do have one caller. We're going to take that caller, and then we're going to get to some of the quick questions in the chat room, and then I'd like to get into the alien agenda as you see it. Hello, caller. This is Doug. What's your first name?
Yeah, hi, Doug. This is Ward from California.
Hey, Ward. How are you?
Good.
Welcome, Ward.
Thank you.
What's your question for Dr. Jacobs?
Yeah, first of all, Dr. Jacobs, it's an honor to speak to you.
Why, thank you, sir.
You're a legend in the field, and I really respect your work, and you're one of the few people that really has credibility in this field because you bring with it integrity and decency and actual investigatory practices, so I thank you for that. I'm just going to cut right to the chase here. I've been listening to your lectures and to a lot of things. As far as what's happening right now, there seems to be a huge sort of like paradigm shift in that the hybrids seem to be doing most of the work now, like in the last year or so, Could you talk more about that and why that has changed and the drastic change that you've seen in this field occur in the last, you know, year or two?
Yes, and we're sort of cutting to the chase here for sure. And so I have to backtrack a little bit to sort of explain this.
And I'll let you listen on the air, Ward, okay?
Thank you.
When I talked about the babies, people had to hold these babies, well, it's not just babies. We see them as babies. We see them as toddlers. We see them as young children, you know, age 7, 8. We see them as older children, 11, 12, whatever. We see them as adolescents. We see them as young adults. And we see them as regular adults. And we don't see them as older adults for reasons that we do not know. Now, when you talk about hybrids, you're suddenly into sort of another world. The first question is, how do you get to be a hybrid? Well, my earliest ideas were the obvious ideas. People report eggs being taken and sperm being taken. And so I figured, well, you take your basic sperm, you take your basic egg, you put it together, and then you either add alien DNA, if there is such a thing as alien DNA, and I don't know, or you alter those the gamete, I guess, or the zygote, in such a way that you're going to get a baby that looks sort of like a cross between alien and human, which is what everybody has been describing. Ugly babies who look sort of like alien and human. And my sense was is that they were saying also that, well, some of them look really quite alien and some of them look really quite human, but most of them are in the middle. And my sense was that if you just take this alien DNA and you inject it or you do whatever it is that you do to alter that, the fertilized egg and sperm, then you're going to get a bell-shaped curve. On the one tail, you're going to get ones that look really quite human, and the other tail, you're going to get ones that look really quite alien. And everybody in the middle is going to look sort of like a cross. And that's sort of what the idea that I labored under for several years. Then somebody told me something that was just a little bit different. And suddenly I realized I was right, but I was too simple-minded. What they told me was that that this adult hybrid had spoken to this woman and said that, quote, something to the point of, my father was like me, meaning the hybrid, and my mother was like you, meaning the human. And then I realized that what's happening here is that they're taking DNA from the hybrid and inserting it into the zygote or whatever they're doing. And when you do that, depending on how the hybrid looks and all, you're going to get a skewed bell-shaped curve. Mm-hmm. You're going to get some that look quite alien, most in the middle, and then a bunch more that look quite human. And if you do this over time, you can't really say generations because they're constantly doing this, you're going to get more and more human-looking hybrids. And that, in fact, is what people have been describing. And starting about, I would say, 15 years ago, maybe a little bit more, people began to describe events that were happening to them that included hybrids. Now, we had seen sort of older hybrids, you know, involved in the abduction process before, cleaning up a little bit if somebody throws up, or they'll clean it up or does whatever humans do. They come out and clean it up. I've seen that. But most of the hybrids have been usually younger, and people are used to teach them what life on Earth is like and what various flora and fauna are and all that in special teaching situations, which I can talk about at length more later on. But what we've seen, though, over the last decade and a half at least, is an increasing involvement of hybrids. Now, people don't know that other people are saying this, in doing abduction work. That is to say, abductions. And we used to see an occasional hybrid in an examining room or else accompanying a person around from time to time. Then we began to see hybrids who were doing some of the procedures to people on the table under the watchful tutelage and gaze of the aliens. And then eventually, starting about 10 years ago or so, you used to see people, hybrids, who were doing complete abduction work from getting people out of their normal environments, doing everything, and no aliens are even present. And so this was the major shift, the major change that we began to see some years back. And we also began to see a lot more human-looking ones, and ones that really couldn't pass if they walked around. They would be weird-looking, but there was a significant number of them where you could not tell the difference. Couldn't tell the difference. Now, that has continued to evolve, shall we say, and we can talk about that a little bit later, but that has been a significant and incredibly important series of changes that have happened, and I've just spent most of my time in my book The Threat came out in 1998, most of my time in the past decade doing basically hybrid research. I mean, I do research on all aspects of it, of course, but it's been the hybrids that has been the main focus of my attention. And starting in 2003, 5 years ago, and we can talk about this a little bit later too, I began to hear accounts that I had never heard before. And believe me, 5 years ago, I heard it all hundreds of times. People would tell me the same thing over and over and over again. I literally had trouble keeping my eyes open, keeping awake. I'd heard it so many times. Then suddenly, people just began to tell me something that I had never heard before. And it was shocking and stunning, and that's what I hear now. That's what everybody's talking about. Well, not everybody, but a lot of people are talking about that. And so it's
interesting.
We're in a period of great change. Let's put it that way. So that's
all right.
That was a dynamite question.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks so much, Ward, for calling in and asking that. Let me ask you a series of questions and maybe get a shorter answer, and then we can move on to what you see is more of what's going on and what the agenda and that sort of thing is.
Answer, you say?
Yeah. on these.
Yeah.
Everybody has to be a wise ass, don't they? Okay. Of course, I would never be one. That's just not who I am. All right.
I'm a professor. I'm supposed to go on and on and on and on.
Yeah. No, you're doing great. I just want to make sure we have time to get to the agenda, too. In regard to what you just said regarding the hybrids and all that, do you still come across abductions that still deal with the grays?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
It depends on the person and what the purpose is, how that person fits into the purpose of the abduction phenomenon. But the grays are in control of everything. That's important to understand. Even though we see hybrid directed events and hybrid this and hybrid that, they answer to the grays.
Okay, cool. Now, this is from a little bit ago in the chat from a true original. The question is, in his research, did he find much of an association with abductees in regard to paranormal experiences after abduction, which continue? So the way I'm reading that, other types of paranormal experiences, maybe psychokinesis or something on that order.
Right. That's a good question. Now, I have to be very careful in how I answer this. And I will start off by saying the most common thing that happens that we know is directly related to abductions. From time to time after an abduction, a person will come back and say, you know, I can read a person's mind. I know what that person is thinking. Now, the point is that on board an object, all communication is telepathic. Now, are people normally telepathic? And the answer, I hate to say this, and I know I'm going to cause people to hate me, but the answer is no.
Right.
If there was even 1 or 2% of the population that was truly telepathic, we'd live in a completely different society.
Yes.
the ramifications of that are so enormous, so gigantic, it is almost impossible to describe the ripple effect of that happening with million, with several million people who could actually tell what was in somebody else's mind. So it's people don't, when they think about telepathy, they think they can tell. They don't understand what they're saying and the ramifications of it. And it's not part of the human condition. It is not. Believe me, it isn't. Diplomacy would be different. Wars would be different. Everything would be different. Everything would be different. But it's not. And people don't know what the hell's going on in anybody else's mind at any given time, no matter how much they think they do. And
you know,
so,
Doctor, one of the... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. One of the things that, and I know I'm going to digress here a little bit, and this could probably lead us into the agenda, you know, a little bit more, but one of the things that I find really disturbing, and I'm sure that you share that with me, is the fact that deception seems to be the rule here, and ongoing secrecy. And that doesn't seem to be changing at all. That seems that agenda seems to keep perpetuating itself. And I'm just wondering if you'd kind of give our audience, you know, your spin on why you think that the need for deception.
I will do that as soon as I'm just going to finish this quick question about what happens to
sure.
people afterwards. And then I'm going to do that because your question also is extremely important on a lot of different levels, and it's going to take at least 2 hours to answer it.
Okay.
But the point is that some people come back and they say, I know I can read that person's mind, and I don't like it. I know what that person is thinking. And this is a person who's just been engaging in telepathic communication with aliens, if I may even use that phrase as crazy as it sounds. And so they, and I've heard this enough. And what they'll say, I mean, enough to think that something is going on, because what they'll say is, I come back and I just know what people are thinking, and then it becomes less the next day, and it trails off, and it lasts for about a week, and it's very disturbing, and I hate it, and I don't ever want it to come back. And after about 7 or 8 days, then it goes away. And I've heard that enough times, as opposed to now I am telepathic and I understand what's going on in everybody's minds forever. I've heard that enough times to think that that is a legitimate after effect of some neurological procedures that did not in some way cut off the telepathy when it should have. And because telepathy, as I said, is not a normal part of the human condition. Now, having said that, people also have what they think are paranormal events. Now, here's where people are going to hate me again. Now, I deal with abductees. I don't deal with people who are not abductees, if possible. I'm not interested in... I know enough about what non-abductees say when they say that they're being abducted, and it has nothing to do with abduction phenomenon. And the way I look at myself is I'm studying the aliens and hybrids, and that's what I'm trying to look at. But they have paranormal events. And every paranormal event that I've looked at, which is things moving in the house or this or that or whatever it is, has ultimately been related to abductions that they have not remembered clearly. Now, that's with abductees. Other people who may not be abductees might have paranormal events, and then you just got me. It's another area. I don't really know much about that area. And so, you know, and I'll leave
but
that
to other
experts. But say
it again. With abductees.
Well, with abductees, they have a series, particularly when they don't know what has happened to them. They see ghosts in gray, you know, all the time, and they think are ghosts, and it's actually part of the abduction phenomenon, or but they chalk them up to ghosts, or they have spirits visiting them in the middle of the night, and of course when we take a look at it, it's not spirits, as they realize right away, or deceased relatives coming to visit them and say goodbye, and when I've looked at those with them once again, they realize right away, oh, this isn't Grandpa. He didn't come back to say goodbye to me. It's not what I thought. So, in other words, their lives, which at one time were filled with such odd and paranormal events that they couldn't slot them properly and could not focus on the abduction phenomenon as the cause of those, suddenly begin to go into a fairly normal mode except for the abduction phenomenon because they just realize they were mistaken. This wasn't paranormal. This was something else. For example, here's just a little tiny example. A guy comes back in an abduction event and he says, you know, I'm going to remember this. And I know I'm going to forget it in the morning, but I know that it's night now. I've got to do something to remind me. So what I'll do is I'll go to my dresser, I'll take my hairbrush, I'll put it on the floor, I'll take my wallet, I'll put it next to the hairbrush, and when I wake up in the morning, I'll remember what happened to me. And they get in the bed. They wake up in the morning, they look over and they say, oh my God, how did that hairbrush and my wallet get on the floor like that? God, was it spirits here? I can't imagine how this possibly could have happened. I remember putting them on the dresser. See what I mean? It becomes a paranormal
yes.
event. They've just forgotten it. But,
right.
Okay, so the answer is yes, there are some after effects. No, it's not. And I'm gonna say here, and I'm gonna be very careful in how I use these sentences. In other words, for the majority of abductees, there are no other events, although for some there might be. But we're still examining those.
Okay.
But we are in a period of great change. Now, the question that the other question you asked, Grant, was what now? I've forgotten already.
Oh, I was, one of the themes that seems to be always running through this and has since the very beginning is deception. And secrecy.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah, okay.
And
without
deception
secrecy,
on whose part, Grant?
Deception
well, on the
part alien. Of the visitors.
Okay,
right.
Okay, good. That was asked in chat.
Right. Without deception, without secrecy, there is no abduction phenomenon. It's just like the ability to control people. If it wasn't secret, well, the person would have the police waiting for him, you know,
right.
or whatever. It's got to be secret. This goes hand in hand. This is one of those baseline phenomena where without secrecy, they can't do it. So, but there's other reasons as well. The problem is this. And I just said cavalierly last hour, oh, they inject fetuses in people, they take fetuses out. The problem is, one of the problems is, without secrecy, they can't abduct people at all because everybody would be remembering and they would
right.
take steps to stop it, you know. But the other problem here is that when they implant a fetus in a woman who acts as a host for incubation for about 6 to 10 weeks, they can't have that woman knowing that she is pregnant. And oftentimes, there is no reason to be pregnant. So if a woman misses her period once or twice, they might chalk it up to something else going on, but it's not going to be pregnancy.
Right.
When, however, she begins to show, that is too late. That breaks secrecy right then and there, because if the problem is that the woman is walking around on her own recognizance with the fetus, with the treasure, with this object that they have gone through a great deal of trouble to create, and she's got it, and she's going about her normal business. She's perfectly fine, and she's away from them. That fetus must be protected. Because if she were to find out that this is injected into and put into her, that it's not a product of normal sexual relations with a, you know, with somebody, then they would just say, get it out tonight. You got to want that thing in me. You know, problems about abortion, all that. They would just be blown away. Just get it out. That cannot be allowed to happen. That destroys the program. So it must be kept secret from her, and that also entails the memory block that people have when they forget what happened to them. That's one of the reasons. Another reason is if you're an abductee and you know you're an abductee and you found this out, and only a tiny percentage of people know this, but if they know that they're abductees, then they may elect not to get married and have kids. The problem here is that when an abductee marries a non-abductee, they have four kids, all their kids will be abductees. It's not the normal genetic situation where one person will have a recessive and dominant genes, and another, and two might be abductees, one won't be, and a third one maybe, that sort of stuff. It's all four kids will be abductees, and they say to themselves, "I'm not going to do that to my kids. I'm just not going to have kids." That can't be allowed either. So the person must not know that they're abductee to maintain a longitudinal quality to the phenomenon by getting it going through the generations, which is what we in fact do see. Not only that, but if an abductee marries a non-abductee, what they're doing is they're incorporating that non-abductee's children into the phenomenon. Whereas if they marry another abductee, it's just, you know, another abductee's children who would have abductee children no matter what. So by marrying a non-abductee and having kids, it spreads out latitudinally as well across the generations. So it's for protection, it's for carrying on the phenomenon at all, it's for protection of the fetus, and it's for continuing the longitudinal and the latitudinal aspects of it. So therefore, secrecy is a linchpin, as well as neurological engagement of the abduction phenomenon. And once again, it just shows you that the importance of neurology, because you can only have secrecy by, in some way, blocking short-term memory. And that's what they do neurologically, because everything is neurological when you get right down to it, in a sense. So they're
okay, let
really,
me ask you,
really good at it.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying they're really good at it.
There's one question from a little bit ago in the chat room, which I think is pertinent. Let me find it here from Mike. What about in the cases you studied with long-term subjects, did any of them deal with substance abuse as a form of escapism?
That has happened oftentimes when they were children. I've dealt with several people who started drinking at around age 9 so they could go to sleep at night. 9, 10, around that. So they would steal into their parents' liquor cabinet and take a couple of swigs and go to sleep. One person became a full-fledged alcoholic, is not that now, and hasn't had a drink in many, many years, and is, in fact, an alcohol counselor. But substance abuse really doesn't, it's such a random phenomenon. Some people smoked weed when they were in college, you know, some didn't. I don't have anybody who's a heroin addict or anything like that. So, but my guess is that if you go out into the great number of abductees, that there might be an increased amount of people like that, because their lives are so different, so odd. They're so frightened at night, and they don't know what's doing it. That this really, I think, if they are, and I haven't met many, but if they are, it really is a case of self-medication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that was the trendy phrase a few years ago, remember?
Sure.
It was self-medication.
Mm-hmm.
But this probably does apply in that regard. However, I do have people who were sort of alcoholic at early on, trying to get away from this phenomenon.
Or heavy drinkers. All right,
yeah,
so let's go
drinkers.
Into motivations. That's been asked in the chat room. What's the motivation? What's the big picture here?
Well,
you got about 20 minutes left. Let's
okay.
get into that.
I'll try to squeeze it into those 20 minutes.
Yeah. Two hours into 20 minutes.
I'm going to ease into this from two different directions. And the first thing I'm going to say is, back in 1950, the famed physicist Enrico Fermi put out something called the Fermi Paradox. Apparently he was at lunch with some other physicists, and they started talking about aliens and life in outer space. This had nothing to do with UFOs at that time. This was not in their mind. And Fermi said, look it. The way humans have evolved is, you know, they climbed out of the earth, they came down from the trees or whatever it is they came from, and ultimately, you know, they started in Africa, the old Abigo Gorge or wherever they started, and ultimately they spread around the world. In other words, they sort of colonized the whole world. In the future, we'll probably be colonizing other planets, is essentially what he's saying. I'm paraphrasing him and I'm adding a little bit,
mm-hmm,
but
sure.
It's part of his argument. If there were aliens out there who were, in fact, had any technology or were technologically savvy, they would be colonizing the planets around us and here and there and everywhere, and we'd be aware of it. We'd see them. We'd know they were there. There'd be telescopes, whatever. So if there are extraterrestrials, where are they? The implication of his question is there aren't any. That was the implication.
Right.
Because we don't see that. And people debated this over and over the years, And my answer to that is, I think Fermi was right. I think that he had the right idea. He had the wrong conclusion, but he had the right idea. He was thinking along the right lines. Now, if you just sort of leave that in the back of your brain for a minute, what I began to get when I wrote Secret Life, and I wrote Secret Life in 1997, was the following kinds of accounts. A person would be taken into a room, and they'd be shown a screen-like device on the wall, let's put it that way. Everything is telepathic, and there might be several people standing there with the mother abductees, all without clothes on, looking like zombies, glassy-eyed, jaws open, and their attention is directed to the screen, and on the screen is a picnic, a normal, average, everyday picnic at a park. And there's people playing ball, there's people at a grill, there's people talking, you know, whatever they're doing, that sort of stuff. And in their mind's ear, they'll hear the words, "Can you tell the difference between us and you?" And they'll look at the screen and look at the screen and stare at it and say, "No, what are you talking about? Everybody looks the same. What do you mean, us and you?" And they'll say, "See? Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that great? Soon we'll all be together. Soon it's going to be wonderful. Soon everybody will know his place. Soon you're just going to love it. We're going to love it. Everybody's going to love it. It's lovely." Or whatever. Something like that. In other words, they're enthused about what's going to happen in the future. And this is a picture which shows how it's going to sort of work. You can't tell the difference. Or people will be told, we'll be taken out the room. There's a screen-like device. These are two actual events. And there is a photograph of sorts. It's like people who are lined up for a class picture on steps or something like that, except there maybe there's 20 people or 11 people or something like that. And once again, they'll have to look at this photograph, in quotes, at this scene, and pick out the different, you know, the ones who, can you tell which ones are us and which ones are you? And once again, they'll look and look and say, no, it doesn't. I can't tell any difference. So then, once again, they'll get the same answer. See, isn't this great? Isn't this wonderful? Soon we'll all be together. Soon we'll all be together. Then other abductees began to report the same thing to me, how without the images, how aliens say, soon we'll all be together. You know, soon it's going to happen. There'll be a big change soon. The change is coming soon. Boy, you're going to love the change. Everybody's going to love it. It's going to be really wonderful. You're going to love it. And I began to think, that's unsettling. And meanwhile, we're seeing more and more hybrids who are looking more and more human, you know what I mean, and doing more and more things, and again, and this, now we begin to see these things, and so I began to think, well, what does the word soon mean?
Really?
Like in 10 minutes or in 1,000 years? What's time to these beings, you know? So they never explained that. That one we could never explain, and I got some woman to sort of said, well, give me a guess. She said, I don't know, maybe the next 30 years. So I figured, okay, 30 years. I think I wrote that, you know. Well, that might have been right. It was within the next 30 years. Because starting in 2003, I began to hear stories that I didn't want to hear. Because what had happened to me was people would say, do you think there are hybrids running around here? You know, you see if there are hybrids on Earth. And I'd say, absolutely not. There's no evidence for that whatsoever. And it made me feel good to say that, because I was taking a conservative stand. I knew the difference between wackiness and non-wackiness, and there was no evidence, and I could take that step back and give me a sense of normality, you know what I mean? I wasn't stepping over the line by saying yes, which made me look like a total raving lunatic. And so I hung on to that. Well, I can't hang on to that anymore. Now when people say, do you think there's hybrids running around here and all that? And the answer is, well, yeah, I do. I think Fermi was right. I think that this is ultimately, an integration program and integration to the society, just as they've told the abductees. I think that the soon is now. I think that we're seeing it. More and more people are coming forward and telling me these things. People have, I've worked with for many years sometimes who've never told me anything like that before. The stories are dovetailing precisely, and it's just I don't want to hear it, and yet that's what people are telling me. And so now the question is, well, why would they want to do that?
Mm-hmm.
That is the ultimate question, and we do not know the answer to that. And if this were psychological, if this were something that people were concocting in their brains for whatever reason, whether it's because they're completely nuts or because of psychological or societal stress or sexual abuse or whatever, we'd know that answer. There'd be a million different answers, because that's what people would tell you. Well, they're coming here because they want, because we're a warlike people and they don't like what we're doing to each other, and they're friendly and they're benevolent. That's why, in other words, we'd know the why. But we don't know the why. And I don't know if we're ever going to learn the why. I don't know if that's possible. I'm very despairing about that question. I don't know if we can learn that. We've learned virtually everything else, but we don't. Well, everything else we know anyway. But we do not have a fix on the why. And I don't think I can go. I don't think I'm going to learn it. I don't think it's going to happen.
Okay. Well, then let me just ask you this question, which seems logical. Next step is from the chat room. You express deep concern and fear for the future. Why?
Because now it's a little bit difficult to explain this, but it's the neurological manipulation. The easiest way to explain it is they can manipulate us neurologically and get us to do whatever they damn well please, and we can't do that to them. That makes us a second-class species, not
yes.
even second-class citizens. It makes us a subspecies in some way. And I don't like that feeling, and I don't like what they're planning to do. They never ask questions about our institutions, our societal, our politics. They don't ask questions about the upcoming election. They never have. They never wanted to know who Monica Lewinsky was. Nothing like that. And I started realizing this early on, before I knew anything about this, and that always puzzled me. Why don't they want to know about political and social and structural institutions in the United States or in any Western European or any country at all? Why don't they? And the answer is, they don't need to. They'll be putting in their own structure. They have their own society. They don't need to do that. They don't need to know that. They might want to know what a dog is and what a goat is, and they might want to know how to go to school, and they might want to know how to get a job, and they might want to learn how to drive, and that we've seen often. But they don't. But in terms of institutions and structure, that they don't care about. This is
okay.
Not,
so the next.
Well, it's disquieting to me. Let's put it that way.
Sure. The next logical question is, if their plan is to integrate and essentially take us over that way, why not take us over just by force?
You know, I don't think that this is a group that does that sort of thing. I think that the marching orders are to do it by subterfuge, surreptitiously, quietly, and eventually that will have the least amount of trouble, the least amount of problems. They won't have roaming gangs looking for hybrids, you know, whatever it is that they're afraid of. And that comes down to the difference between gray aliens and hybrids. Hybrids can control you and get you to do whatever they damn well please. But with less authority and less neurological power than the gray aliens. And the more human-like they are, the less power they have in terms of being able to do that. And so that makes them more vulnerable, because they're not, it's not an instant control thing. So, but it is control nonetheless. And therefore what we see is that the area of secrecy and security has been raised enormously. I cannot emphasize that enough. it has been raised enormously from in the old days when people would say, you know, I'm remembering everything and I'm telling it to Dave Jacobs, and they would say, don't do that. That is not good. You're endangering future generations. That's bad. Now get up on the table. Now it's a whole nother world. Now security is critical because the ones who are integrating must be protected.
So as Mike says in the chat, this is a passive invasion.
Yes, exactly. Now, I just forgot what I was going to say.
Well, you know, the other thing that's really kind of alarming about it is how they present these beautiful, lovely pictures, this indoctrination of how things are going to be so much better, and humanity, although they don't say it in those terms, everybody's going to be happy. The pictures
right.
that you painted in the thread about how we see mixed groups of hybrids and humans living this idyllic sort of existence is almost like also a psychological indoctrination as well.
Physical, coupled
with the psychological.
I think you're right about that. And I also think it's just from their point of view that for them,
absolutely.
It is going to be wonderful. You know, it's going to be great. They're going to love it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I've discovered about that I'd like to write about if I can ever do this, and right now I have no book, I have no manuscript, I have no nothing, but one of these days if I can ever get my act together, I'd like to write about the bureaucracy of this. It's not like they're just coming in and moving in. There's a whole bureaucratic structure in place to have this happen. This is extremely well thought out. It's not just, okay, you move in here now or whatever. There's a whole world of protection, of dealing with abductees, of dealing with what I call in the threat personal project hybrids, all of whom have functions within the integration program. It's a complicated one with the aliens on top and certain, and of course, if you read the threat, you know that there's a hierarchy of aliens with the insect-like ones who are the ultimate authority in this. But you see the power flowing downward, and you do see this bureaucracy in place to help this happen, which when you think about it, has to be there. It just has to be there. And that's what people are describing. So it's a complicated business, and I cannot say, I can't deny that it's happening anymore. It is what I am finding. And even though I don't like it, and it makes me seem like a raving lunatic when I talk about it, I have to go where the evidence leads me, and it leads me into the positions that used to be severely embarrassing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have that safety net of saying, no, absolutely not. I can't say that anymore. I have to say, yeah, I think so. And I know that the more that I talk about this, and the crazier it sounds, and the less that the academic community or the scientific community is going to look at this thing. And I just have accepted that. I said, okay, that's just the way it's going to be, and there's nothing I can do about it. And I don't have, Nobel laureates on my side. I don't have the physical community or any scientists at all, really, in en masse within the mainstream community to back me up. I don't have any. I've got me and my version of hypnosis, and I'm telling people to take my word for it. And I know that is as weak a form of evidence as I could ever possibly come forward with, given the message, which is as extreme as one can possibly get. And I know that I am, believe me, I am extremely aware of the conundrum that this presents to me. And yet, I just go ahead and do it anyway, thinking to myself, well, I'll retire in a few years, and nobody will give a damn one way or the other. And But this is what
takes
I have
courage.
Found. Well, either that or foolhardiness, one of the two. So,
well, you know,
now,
one of the things I always thought was really fascinating was a lot of times when people have been abducted, they've asked their abductors, you know, why are you doing this to me? You have no right to do this to me. And I've read where several responses have been, you know, we have every right to do what we're doing.
That's right.
You.
Exactly.
Or
they
you
have the
chose
right.
to. Or you
yes.
chose to.
Well, not so much that, but certainly more. They have the right. They can do it. In a sense, their position is might makes right, and the way they look at it is they are doing the right thing for them. The moral nuance is not strong in this community. This is a community that is a telepathic community that shares thoughts readily. There's no rebels. There's no plotting in the hallways. There's nothing like that. In a telepathic community, it's very difficult to have something like that. It's in a community that is very, very tightly controlled, extremely organized, and everybody is created for a function. And it's built right into their genes that this is what they have to do. We, even though they're hybrids and they look like us, you're dealing with a whole different sort of wiring in the brain. Not completely different, but different enough to make them very different from us. Now, Grant, earlier you asked about the government during the break or something like that, and maybe I should address that now because everybody wants to know.
Yeah, we've just got about 2 minutes, so.
Okay, here's the thing. People say, well, the government knows, they've got secret plans, they've got pickled aliens, they've got a UFO hidden in the whatever it is. And my answer to that is, God, I hope that's true. I hope that they're keeping everything from us. I hope that they know what's going on. It's a dream's answer. You know what I mean? Answer to my dreams. Because at least they know about it. They're working on it. If they knew that this is extraterrestrial that's going on, that they would be sinking money into it like there's no tomorrow. They'd be preparing for it. I hope it's true. All right, so they're lying to us. So what? That's any different than any other thing in politics? So the point is that I hope it's true. People say, well, what about the shadow government? There's some sort of a shadow government. And my answer to that is I hope that's true, too. I mean, just as long as they're looking at it, as they're working on it, that's the way you have to think about the government. Unfortunately, I don't think it's true. I just hope it's true. I think that the government gets its cues from the scientific community, and we are at a point in UFO and abduction research now, at this minute, where hostility and antipathy toward the subject has never been higher than in the history of the UFO and abduction controversy. It has never been higher. It's not that they're not interested in it. They're downright aggressively hostile to it. There's never been anything like it since 1947. And so if the government is hiding stuff from us and they're secretly watching it, I hope that's true.
Well, you know, it's been amazing. And here's one last question from the chat room. Wish we could take all of them. Will the intervention slowly phase humans out and the hybrids being phased in? From Diane
Fuller. I wish
Fuller.
I knew. Yeah, that's a great question. And I wish I knew the answer to that. I think that abductees are of extreme importance to them and very useful for them, and they use them like crazy. There's absolutely no morality involved with using abductees. They use them all the time, and the number of abductions for abductees who are helping hybrids integrate has gone up drastically. But non-abductees, I fear for. Those that would be me, for example, the people who don't have a whole lot of stake in the program, I think. I don't think that they think about us a whole lot, and they never talk about us. They never mention us. It's disquieting, if I may use that word again.
All right, so we got less than a minute remaining, and we need to wrap it up really quick. And Dr. Jacobs, thank you so much for joining us tonight. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and if you'll hang with us just for a moment, and everybody in the chat room and everybody who's listening to this, either live or on the archive, we really appreciate your time and interest. Hope that you've gotten something out of it. I've been riveted. It's been absolutely fantastic. Grant, good questions, and just an incredible interview, I think, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. It's been a real pleasure, Dr. Jacobson, and we really appreciate the work that you've done, and you know, maybe we can have you back on the show one of these times down the road, because we would really enjoy it. This is such a large topic to talk about. So thank you so much.
On and on, and I thank you very much. And it's always interesting to talk about.
Yeah. All right. Well, hang with us. And for our listeners, just a quick reminder, Visit us at paranexus.org. We have a conference coming up a week from Saturday on October 25th in Tampa. If you're in the area, we'd love to have you join us. There's information on paranexus.org. If you can't join us in person, you can join us live online. We'll be broadcasting it. There's information on paranexus.org. And Dr. Jacobs, real quick, your website?
www.ufoabduction.com. Now, it's important to understand there's no S on the end of abduction.
Okay, so not plural. Lots of books there. Read his books. Thanks so much, everyone. Have a great night.